It's Monday, November 25, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. For the past several years, the nation of Iran has been on the front lines of international controversy precisely because that nation, a rogue nation in terms of the international order, has been doing its best to achieve a nuclear weapon. And even at the same time, there have been many in the world who have been doing virtually everything within their diplomatic power to limit Iran's march towards a nuclear capability. In the Middle East, it's not only Israel that, of course, is gravely concerned about a nuclear-armed Iran. It is the Gulf states as well. And beyond that, it is Europe. In a rare international unanimity, virtually every civilized nation has registered outright concern, if not fear, of Iran reaching a nuclear capability. As a matter of fact, looking just at the nation of Israel, that nation has been very clear that it will act militarily if necessary and unilaterally if necessary if the rest of the world lacks the resolve or the capability to deal with the challenge of Iran. But on yesterday, President Barack Obama announced that the United States and other world powers, five nations in particular, had announced that they had reached an accord with Iran that would, in the words of the New York Times, quote, temporarily freeze Iran's nuclear program and lay the foundation for a more sweeping agreement, end quote. The closer you look at the accord reached yesterday, the less there is to it, and what is there appears more dangerous. What we're talking about here is not a significant action by Iran to bow to international pressure and accept the demands the international community has been making for years in return for a lessening of sanctions. But as Michael Gordon of the New York Times reports, for the first time in nearly a decade, American officials announced this international agreement had been reached to halt, the word here to watch is halt, much of Iran's nuclear program and roll some elements of it back. That raises the whole question of what the word halt means, used in this sentence or used in any presidential announcement about the agreement. Speaking from the state dining room in the White House, President Obama hailed it as the most, quote, significant and tangible, end quote, progress of the campaign that began when he took office. But, of course, the diplomatic campaign actually began long before that, reaching back into the administrations of both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. The president said, quote, today, that diplomacy opened a new path toward a world that is more secure. A future, he said, in which we can verify that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful and that it cannot build a nuclear weapon, end quote. But of course, when we're talking about Iran, let's remind ourselves that we are talking about what is genuinely and accurately described as a rogue nation, a nation that is outside all the normal bounds of international behavior, the behavior of nations. You're talking about a nation, the supreme leader of which has been making dramatic statements about Israel in terms of its annihilation, even in the last several days. And yet the President of the United States announced this agreement as if it is a great diplomatic breakthrough. On the other hand, the Wall Street Journal points out that the agreement adopted in Geneva yesterday actually, quote, takes Iran a giant step closer to becoming a de facto nuclear power, end quote. As the Wall Street Journal points out, under the deal, Iran gets sanctions relief, but it does not have to give up its centrifuges that enrich uranium, does not have to stop enriching, does not have to transfer control of its enrichment stockpiles, and does not have to shut down its plutonium reactor at Arak. That's an incredible list of the things Iran does not have to do in order to have signed this accord. As the journal points out, President Obama's weekend statement glossed over these canyon-sized holes. He said Iran, quote, cannot install or start up new centrifuges, end quote, but it already has about 10,000 operational centrifuges that it can continue to spin for at least another 6 months, says the journal. Why does Tehran need so many centrifuges if not to make a bomb at the time that it so pleases? So what's really going on here? We need to look very carefully at what this means in the domestic context. When a president of the United States finds himself in domestic difficulty, as the current president does, a president often tries to find an international success in order to offset a domestic controversy, a domestic failure, or a domestic political impasse. This is true regardless of the political party that is represented by the president in office. This is a common pattern to watch regardless of who is president. But in this case, the president is Barack Obama, and President Obama finds himself in a very difficult position in terms of domestic politics. He is in concentric circles of domestic political trouble. And that's why this president has sought very hard to find an international agreement that he can announce, and he announced one yesterday. But a closer look at this agreement indicates that it probably does not bring us closer to peace, but rather closer to a collapse of peace and to some kind of military action. And furthermore, rather than bringing a rogue nation to the court of justice and to international norms of national behavior, it allows Iran to go on at the brink of developing a nuclear weapon. As I say, this is true in terms of the pattern, regardless of the president in office. This pattern pertains, as I pointed out, regardless of the party or the individual in office. When it comes to American presidents, they habitually look for an international agreement to announce when they find themselves in domestic political difficulty. George Will, writing at the end of last week, writes about President Obama in an article entitled How a Presidency Unravels. There is a great deal of worldview and moral insight in George Will's column. Writing about President Obama's most recent political behavior, he quotes Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who defines President Obama as someone who burns down your house, then shows up with an empty water bucket, then lectures you about how defective the house was. That's not supposed to be an incendiary statement, but rather revealing of the logic that President Obama has used in terms of his defense of his own policies and his attempt to get out of a domestic political difficulty. Will then writes, what is now inexplicably called Obama's fix for the chaos he has created, speaking of the Affordable Care Act, is surreal. He gives you permission to reoccupy your house if you can get someone to rebuild it, but only for another year. What we're looking at here, says George Will, is the unraveling of a presidency, and Americans have seen it happen before, looking not only at Republicans such as Richard M. Nixon, but also at Democrats such as Jimmy Carter. But speaking of Jimmy Carter, George Will writes that Carter found himself trusted in terms of his character, but distrusted in terms of his competence. President Obama now runs a double danger, mistrusted by the American people, both in terms of his character and his competence. He then goes to a book that was written by a friend of Obama, David Remnick, who is editor of The New Yorker. He wrote the book entitled The Bridge, The Life and Rise of Barack Obama. That author quotes Valerie Jarrett, a White House insider that is so much of an insider that she is often described as the person closest to President Obama, his most loyal aide. Valerie Jarrett told David Remnick this, quote, he, speaking of President Obama, knows exactly how smart he is. I think that he has never really been challenged intellectually. He's been bored to death his whole life. He's just too talented to do what ordinary people do. He would never be satisfied with what ordinary people do, end quote. George Will seizes upon that to say that here is an indicative issue. Here you have a president described by his closest and most intimate aide as someone who simply doesn't do what ordinary people do. And clearly, he doesn't think as ordinary people think. George Will's column is must reading for anyone who takes leadership seriously, presidential leadership or leadership in any other arena. The issues of competence and character always go together. Leadership requires both. And to those two C's, I would add a third, conviction. But competence and character cannot be severed the way some people might like to sever them. When it came to President Carter, it was true that he was more trusted in his character than in his competence. And when it came to Richard Nixon, you had the opposite problem, more trusted in terms of his competence than his character. Leadership requires that the president or any leader in a similar kind of context be understood to be both competent and an individual of character. But if the incompetence is rooted in statements made by the president and in what the president knew was already a feature of the legislation he defends, in other words, as President Obama now finds himself vis-a-vis the Affordable Care Act, it's very hard for the president not to take hits in terms of both competence and character. And it's in that context that a president, this president in particular, is well understood to need something to which he can point. And this kind of international agreement announced Sunday in the state dining room of the White House is just such an example. It should tell us something that President Obama made this announcement even on a Sunday, not even waiting until Monday, just weeks after the nation of France, of all things, had to pull the United States and other nations from the precipice of signing an agreement with Iran that would have been absolutely disastrous. This one, it turns out, may be just slightly less disastrous. Time will tell. Ending a tradition of 225 years, on Thursday, Democrats in the United States Senate ended the filibuster when it comes to presidential nominations. That is a major, indeed a seismic shift in American politics, and one that we should watch very closely. What took place here had been warned about and threatened years ago by Republicans, but Republicans did not do it. The threat was made by Republicans back during the administration of President George W. Bush after Democrats innovated by using the filibuster against presidential nominees, judicial nominees in particular, who clearly had a majority support. If there had been an up or down vote in the Senate, those judicial nominees would have gone forward. But Democrats, then in the Senate minority, obstructed using the filibuster. It's very interesting to see how the tables are now turned. Now that the Democrats are in the Senate majority, with a Democratic president in the White House, they have changed the rules. When you talk about the Senate and the filibuster rule, most Americans don't understand just how important this is. But we often forget that the Senate is intended by our constitutional framers to be the great brake on the impulse of government to act hastily and radically. Indeed, the Senate, with its six-year terms, and the Senate, with its rule of two senators from every state, regardless of population, is the only real break that there is in terms of our elected government. And now that the filibuster rule has been modified by the Democrats following through with the so-called nuclear option, the limitations of government actually took a huge blow. Limited government itself was assaulted by the Democrats in this vote on Thursday. My concern is not so much the partisan politics here, because honesty compels us to say that the Republicans were tempted to do the same about a decade ago, but they didn't do it. There is an enormous weight in the United States Senate on behalf of tradition, because those traditions are not only a matter of old formalities, they are a matter of how the Senate actually conducts its work and has conducted its important work for the better part of well over now 200 years. Several things have become very apparent, even in the aftermath of a 52-48 vote, meaning that Senator Reid did not even get all of the Democrats, there are 55 of them, to vote for this measure. But as Peter Nicholas and Janet Hook of the Wall Street Journal point out, it is now known that President Obama personally lobbied at least three Democratic senators who were unsure about how they would vote. As they report, a Senate Democratic aide said that President Obama called senators who were on the fence and told them, quote, how important this was to him and our ability to get anything done for the rest of the term, end quote. Why would this have to do so much with getting something done? It is because, as the Wall Street Journal and others have pointed out, President Obama increasingly intends to act by executive order, not going through Congress for legislation. As the Journal reports, one insider in the White House told the reporters, quote, we expect a lot of our progress is going to be on the executive side, because with Congress, there hasn't been a lot of success there, end quote. Well, that's a very interesting statement. It points to the fact that when you have a separation of powers and you're talking about the importance of legislation here, a president now trying to go around that by executive order is basically acting in a way that innovates in our constitutional system of government. The reason why the filibuster was broken with respect to judges, particularly to be appointed to the District of Columbia U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, is because that court often rules on the limits of presidential power by executive action. By putting a predominance of democratically appointed judges on that panel, President Obama clearly and now publicly intends to act more boldly in terms of his executive orders, even more boldly than in the past, and to have judges, a majority of judges on that panel, to support him in so doing. He is appointing activist judges who encourage the use of executive orders and the expansive power of government. Once again, limited government took a huge hit on last Thursday. But if limited government took a huge hit, hypocrisy took a great step forward. And, once again, we need to note very carefully that hypocrisy happens on both sides of the partisan aisle. But in this case, the hypocrisy takes place in the editorial pages of the New York Times. Friday's edition of that very influential paper ran a lead editorial that is entitled, Democracy Returns to the Senate. Really? Democracy returns to the Senate? What action brought that about? Well, say the editors, the ending of the filibuster for judicial and other presidential nominees. Fed up, they write, with endless blockades by Republicans, a majority ends the filibuster on nominations. They then wrote, for 5 years, Senate Republicans have refused to allow confirmation votes on dozens of perfectly qualified candidates nominated by President Obama for government positions. They then write that the majority of Democrats, quote, did the only logical thing and stripped away their, speaking of Republican power, to block the president's nominees, end quote. They then wrote, in a 52-48 vote that substantially altered the balance of power in Washington, no argument with their judgment there, the editors went on to say the Senate changed its most infuriating rule and effectively ended the filibuster on executive and judicial appointments. From now on, if any senator tries to filibuster a presidential nominee, that filibuster can be stopped with a simple majority, not the 60-vote requirement of the past. That means, they wrote, a return to the democratic process of giving nominees an up or down vote, allowing them to be either confirmed or rejected by a simple majority, end quote. Why then do I say hypocrisy took a great step forward? It is because a simple search on the site of the New York Times reveals an editorial I remembered from May the 21st of 2005. As we might say, that was then, this is now. Writing then about the filibuster used in exactly the same way, the editors wrote, quote, "There is a centuries-old Senate tradition that a minority can use the filibuster to block legislation or nominees. The Congressional Research Service has declared that the nuclear option would require that, quote, one or more of the Senate's precedents be overturned or interpreted otherwise than in the past," end quote. Thus, the editor set up their argument for why the Republicans must not revoke the filibuster for presidential nominations. They wrote about the very same filibuster used in exactly the same way at that time by Democrats, and they wrote, quote, "The filibuster protects minority rights," and they went on to say that senators should reject the importance of that principle. It is the reason that senators from sparsely populated states are given a vote equal to that of senators from densely populated states, end quote. In other words, the New York Times here is reflecting an entirely different, indeed categorically opposite position, not only on the filibuster, but on the Constitution in a period of less than 10 years. That was then, this is now. Back in 2005, in this editorial published on the 21st of May, they wrote that for the Republican majority in the Senate then to revoke the filibuster rule would be, quote, "to trample the minority," end quote. And yet, in the editorial published on Friday of last week, they went so far as to declare the elimination of the same rule, democracy now returning to the Senate. Writing back during that controversy in 2005, columnist David Brooks of the New York Times wrote, "Republicans now threaten to change the Senate rules and end the filibuster on judicial nominees. That they have a right to do so is certain. That doing this would destroy the culture of the Senate and damage the cause of limited government is also certain," end quote. What is now certain is that that cause of limited government took a severe hit last Thursday. And then the cause of avoiding hypocrisy took a huge hit the following day in the editorial page of the New York Times. But wait just a minute. What if we look at other newspapers and other political analysts as well? You're going to find at least the temptation of a similar pattern. In other words, if you look back at many conservative editorials written back in 2005, they took the opposite position of the New York Times then. And now they're taking the opposite position of the New York Times now. Hypocrisy, it turns out, is on both sides of the argument, on both sides of the aisle, and on both sides of the human equation. So what do we as Christians learn from that? There was huge hypocrisy evident on the editorial page of the New York Times on Friday. Blatant, undiluted, seemingly unembarrassed hypocrisy. But when it comes to hypocrisy on this issue, it turns out it's more widespread. It's not just on one side. It was on both sides, depending on whose ox was gored, so to speak, then or now. But when we look at something like this, it should remind Christians that moral hypocrisy is closer to us all than we would like to think. After all, the New York Times still has that editorial from 2005 on its website available for anyone to search and see. And it appeared to have no moral or cognitive dissonance in running the editorial on Friday as if it had never made the contrary argument just a few years previous. But how many of us do the same thing and do not note and are not embarrassed that we've even done it? So my point today in raising this problem with the New York Times, the hypocrisy on its editorial page, is not just to throw a stone at one of the nation's most influential newspapers, but rather to say that editorial board is indicative of the human condition, a human condition that Christians uniquely understand, because we understand not only the origin of sin and the consequences of sin, but the subtleness of sin and the seduction of what it means to be a sinner. So this story should cause us to look to the Constitution, to look to the newspaper, to look to the court, and to look in the mirror. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.